Morning.
Morning.
May it please the court, I'm Zachary Naylor of Chimicles and Tekellis. I represent Wayne County Employees Retirement System, the appellant and plaintiff in this action, joined today by Pamela Tekellis, Robert Kreiner, and Megan Adams of my firm. And I've asked to reserve 4 minutes of my time for rebuttal. This appeal challenges the dismissal of an action which in its initial stages challenged a buyout, a sale of control of the Activision company, and control was sold from the Activision public stockholders to Vivendi, a French company. We've raised three issues on appeal. First, that the Court of Chancery failed to appropriately apply the enhanced scrutiny standard required in a sale of control. Second, that the court incorrectly dismissed claims that insider directors on the Activision board breached their duty of loyalty. And third, that the court incorrectly dismissed claims that the outside members of the Activision board breached their duty of loyalty in connection with the sale of control. And we submit that any of those, each of those errors gives this court grounds to reverse that decision. In a sale of control, the director's fiduciary duties oblige them to seek a transaction that maximizes value for stockholders. And that sale of control is a significant circumstance for the stockholders because from that point forward, their voting power will be subjugated to the control of that new controlling stockholder who's buying a majority. And they're also losing then a right to a control premium, which is going to be gone forever after the sale of control. And for that reason, the court has adopted an enhanced scrutiny when reviewing sales of control.
So you're saying there's a Revlon claim that was pleaded, and the court erroneously dismissed it because it was the claim was well stated.
That is correct. We've claimed that with respect to all of the directors of Activision in the sale of control, we've stated a claim for a breach of the duty of loyalty in connection with the sale of control, and that was a Revlon claim here. And so the claim should have been subject to enhanced scrutiny.
Well, do you agree that you start with a complaint rather than itself to determine the sufficiency of the allegation?
Yes, absolutely. The complaint should be judged under the 12B6 standard, but also through the lens of enhanced scrutiny because that's what applies to a sale of control. And so when you're reviewing a Revlon claim under enhanced scrutiny, the court will look to whether or not the conduct of the board was reasonable under the circumstances, whether the decision-making process was adequate. If the board passes that test, then you move to a deferential business judgment review of the sale of control. If the board fails that test, you are then going to be exposed to an entire fairness analysis down the road. And we submit that the first error that the Court of Chancery made was to begin with the business judgment rule rather than beginning with the enhanced scrutiny state of mind. And that thereafter skewed the review in a way that was more deferential to the board than it should have been under enhanced scrutiny, because when you're looking at a case in enhanced scrutiny, there is a burden on the directors.
Is it accurate to say that the court began with the business judgment rule rather than with enhanced scrutiny? My understanding, and you correct me if I'm wrong, is that the chancellor did address the argument that this is a Revlon case because there was a change of control, a fact that nobody disputes. And that Revlon, the Revlon duties, so to speak, were not complied with because the people on the Activision side of the negotiation gave up their demand for a premium, and in fact, no premium was received in the deal. My understanding is that the court said that there was no basis to conclude from the face of the complaint that there wasn't a premium, even though there may not have been a particular percentage of the consideration that had been earmarked as a premium.
I think Your Honor raised a couple of points in there, and I'll address them in turn. The first was whether or not the Court of Chancery recognized it as a sale of control. And yes, I do believe that's accurate, that in the opinion the court characterized this as a sale of control and a Revlon case. However, in the opinion, the court also expressed the sentiment that the appropriate starting place in evaluating the fiduciary duty claims is the well-established presumption of the business judgment rule. So I think when you start in that place, there's a color to the review that is different than if you are starting in, I'm reviewing this under enhanced scrutiny and viewing it with a burden on the defendants. But I do agree with Your Honor that there was a determination that the complaint failed to state a claim under Revlon, but I think that was colored in a way that was inappropriate because it began at a business judgment review rather than taking that first look in enhanced scrutiny, which would have been appropriate in a sale of control.
Well, even if the court had reversed the order of its analysis, are you saying that the result might have been different?
I think that's certainly a possibility. Because they're in enhanced scrutiny, there is supposed to be at least some burden on the defendant directors to show that their actions were reasonable. And that's not the standard in business judgment. In business judgment, you're approaching...
Excuse me.
Yes.
If that were the case, then if you've got a Revlon claim, it can't be dismissed.
No, I don't think...
Because what you seem to be saying is that the defendant has to come forward with some showing before the court can be satisfied that the claim is worthy of being defeated. And so if you have a complaint and a motion to dismiss, you have to survive the motion to dismiss because all you've got is the complaint and no response, no defense by the defendants. But before you even get to that, the complaint has to allege facts that would support such a claim. And didn't the court say that's where you failed?
I absolutely am not suggesting that there's some automatic pass on a motion to dismiss where there's a Revlon claim. That's not our argument at all, and we agree that you certainly still have to plead facts that indicate that there's been a breach of the duty of loyalty in the sale process that makes it unreasonable. I think where that burden on the defendants comes in is in judging the complaint, and it's not a complete deference to the actions of the board as you would have under business judgment, but there's more of a look at the conduct of the board that questions whether or not there's been a reasonable conduct here that is not as deferential as you would have if you just began with business judgment.
Then why don't we just focus on what's in your, the specifics of what's in your complaint that in your view the court didn't pay attention to or didn't give enough deference to or whatever that would support the claim?
Yes, the court, one of the keystone findings in the court's opinion that there was no claim stated here was that the inside directors were not interested, and we have submitted that the logic there is flawed. The insider management directors, that's Mr. Kodak and Mr. Kelly, we have alleged had a monetary and also a personal professional interest in closing the transaction. The court's opinion suggests that because the outside directors approved the amount of compensation they would receive, that cleanses an interest on behalf of the insiders. But I think that there's a logical flaw in that analysis insofar as what the insider directors are interested in is triggering the payments, and that's where the conflict arises. It may be that the total amounts were reasonable, and this is not a compensation case. We're not arguing about the amounts of the compensation, but we do say that an interest arises when you're trying to trigger the payment.
Just, Mr. Naylor, it sounds to me like you're arguing that for us to even address the Revlon claim, we first have to address the loyalty claim. I mean, you're tying the two together. And tell me if I'm right or wrong about that. It may be that you can have, at least as a theoretical matter, directors who are completely loyal and yet drop the ball and fail to get the highest price or value reasonably available. And if that is the case, they still don't comply with Revlon.
That's correct. But what we're saying is that we understand that you need to have engaged in a process that's not reasonable. There's going to have to be a breach of duty, and that's going to have to arise from either loyalty or care. There's no dispute here that there's a 102b7 provision that governs the actions of the directors here. So if their failure to maximize value arises from some careless action, then we recognize that there's not going to be a claim. What we've pled is that it was a problem with their loyal conduct in the sale of control, which led to an unreasonable process that resulted in not a non-maximizing of the value available to Activision stockholders in the transaction.
As to the outside directors, your loyalty claim against them is based upon the fact they were allegedly dominated by the inside directors?
That's right. They failed to provide for a disinterested decision-making body. And what we've said is that...
And what are the facts that support that, other than the fact that the inside directors attended meetings?
Well, that is one of the facts, and I think that's an important fact. The inside directors were the sole source of information provided to the outside directors, them along with the investment banker, who we've also said there's a problem with the independence of. So if all the information coming through to the outside directors is processed through this lens of interestedness and disloyalty, which we've alleged infects the inside management directors, then there's little chance of the outside directors serving as a independent decision-making body.
And why isn't that a due care claim?
Well, because it goes to their independence in the process. We're not suggesting that Mr. Kotick necessarily controlled the amount of wealth that these individuals would have down the road. So it's not that type of an independence claim. But what we're saying is, in the context here, and whenever you're evaluating a sale of control, you have to look at the factual context. And in the context here, the individuals have set up a process which failed to allow them to act as an independent decision maker. And when you look at the record, at the beginning, their intention was to act as an independent decision-making body. They set up a committee that would be empowered to negotiate with Vivendi, to obtain independent advice from Allen, to evaluate alternatives. And what we've said is that they didn't do any of that. Instead, they let Mr. Kotick, Mr. Kelly, Mr. Allen go out, run this process, and then during the course of running this process, those interested directors were unreasonable in trying to obtain a value maximizing transaction, and that the outside directors let that happen. We've also said that the outside directors set it as a goal to obtain a control premium for Activision stockholders, and that once they were met with resistance by Vivendi in the dealings, they threw up their hands and they walked away and they said, well, we can't get it, there's not going to be one, and we've alleged that they failed entirely to get a control premium here. So well, those are the facts, and we pointed the court to
Mr. Naylor.
Yes,
you do allege, do you not, that the directors on the Activision side failed to obtain a value maximizing transaction? In your words,
yes, we do.
Did the court agree with that? That is, did the court agree that that fact had been pled?
The court did not agree with that.
Why not? Why did it commit error if you say you allege that?
Well, there's a couple of reasons. As I understand it, the court found that, A, that there was no disloyalty or interestedness by the outside or by the insiders, and because of that, they did not infect the process. So the Court of Chancery found that there was no disloyalty at that level.
But I'm talking about the outcome of the process now, not the process.
In the outcome of the process, the court held that there was no requirement that there be a control premium in the transaction. And the way we approach that is sort of...
Did the court say that, or did the court say, didn't the court say that, you know, that the control premium was buried in the transaction price, and the fact that there was no way to earmark it separately doesn't mean that there wasn't one.
Well, that's correct. Is that there was some finding that it could have been included in what the exchange ratio was, and we've said that's not really possible here because there.
Are you saying you pled facts that from which we can infer, and that the court below should have inferred did not result in a control premium and therefore no value maximizing transaction?
That's right. We have pled those facts. We've looked at the result of the transaction, taking it apart piece by piece in our pleadings, and said we cannot discern a control premium in any aspect of this transaction. In addition, we've looked at the initial exchange ratio, which is where, under the court's reasoning, that perhaps the control premium is buried, and we said it can't be buried in this exchange ratio because no matter what the exchange ratio was.
The exchange ratio was not decided upon in connection with the actual values of the two companies. Correct?
That's correct.
And secondly, in any event, the Activision negotiators gave up their initial demand for a premium.
Right, and so the facts spell out that there was a desire for control premium that wasn't obtained, and then they accepted an alternative which didn't reflect a control premium. Those are our allegations.
You're into your rebuttal time, which you're welcome to use or not.
If the court has any other questions for me now, I'll certainly take them. Otherwise, I'll reserve my time.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Ed Micheletti of Skadden, Arp, Slate, Marr, and Flom on behalf of the Activision defendants. We respectfully request that this Court affirm Chancellor Chandler's well-reasoned opinion below dismissing this action. Appellant has failed to state a claim against the Activision defendants for breach of fiduciary duty. Even where Revlon applies, as here, to the transaction, appellant must still allege a breach of either the duty of care or duty of loyalty in order to state a claim. That's an issue that this Court squarely addressed in the decision of Malpied versus Townsend. Appellant was suggesting otherwise during the opening argument, but Malpied at pages 1083 to 1084 in the Atlantic Second Report opinion makes it clear that although Revlon imposes an enhanced scrutiny of certain transactions involving sale of control, it does not eliminate the requirement that plaintiffs plead specific facts to support the underlying claims for a breach of fiduciary duty in connecting the sale transaction. And, Your Honors, we submit that that was not done here, and that was the basis, ultimately, for the Court's decision below.
So you're making a two-pronged argument, I gather. First, and tell me if I have this right, first there has to be a Revlon violation. Second, in order for the directors to be held monetarily liable, assuming that there was a violation, there has to be a breach of the duty of loyalty as distinguished from the breach of the duty of care.
That's right.
Let's focus on the first leg of that analysis. You agree that Revlon applies?
We do.
All right.
We're not disputing that.
Do you agree that that there was no control premium obtained here? That is, if the complaint is properly credited, as it must be on a motion to dismiss?
The answer is we don't agree that there was no control premium here. We believe there was a control premium embedded in the deal and that appellant's argument is misleading.
But and okay, go ahead.
It's twofold, and as the court below held as well. The premium here embedded in the deal value at $27.50 was a 25% premium over the unaffected stock price the day before the deal was announced on December 2nd. The unaffected stock price being $22.14. So there was a premium associated with the deal value. The plaintiffs are using the phrase control premium here interchangeably with the concept of a separate cash payment being made on top of the deal value itself. The deal was Activision stock to Vivendi in return for an extremely valuable Vivendi asset, a subsidiary of Vivendi called Vivendi Games, which owned Blizzard Entertainment, which in turn owns and develops a wildly successful online video game with 11 million cash-paying subscribers, Well, and the appellant alleges they were on target to meet their expectations. And
Mr. Micheletti, the problem I have, and maybe you can dispel it for me, is that while what you've just argued is certainly a reasonable inference from the complaint, it can also be reasonably inferred from the complaint that there was that while there may have been a 25% premium over the market price, that there was no control premium, that is, no separate value negotiated for the surrender of control, and indeed that the Activision people agreed to forego that demand. The complaint does say that, and my question is why, therefore, isn't there a conflicting inference that goes against your side, which required the court to credit it for purposes of a motion to dismiss?
No, Your Honor, I don't think they properly plead. They say those things in the complaint, but they're conclusory. I don't think they properly plead that there was no control premium paid here. It ignores the reality of the deal. The deal did not involve a cash payment.
Actually, the complaint goes further, though. It says that the initial going-in position of the Activision negotiators was, you know, we want to get a control premium. And that was their position until a certain stage was reached, in which point they simply abandoned that position.
On those points, Your Honor, they were talking about a request for what was described as either a top-up right or a post-merger tender offer. Those were the points that they were saying that the independent board members were seeking when they were actually directing how they wanted the negotiations to proceed with Vivendi.
That's a spin. That's a spin, but that's not what the complaint says.
Oh, well, Your Honor, I agree that the complaint says that, but I think in isolation it says that. I think when the complaint is fairly read, those are conclusory statements in the context of the facts that were alleged in the complaint.
I mean, isn't the time for spinning once a factual record is developed and not in a complaint?
That's a good question, Your Honor. I don't believe I'm spinning. I think the chancellor below read the complaint as he was required to do. I think it's a process focus here. And what the court said below about the control premium, in addition to what I've said here, is that the argument puts the cart before the horse. That the focus here is on whether or not the board properly exercised their duty of care and loyalty in an attempt to seek out the best value reasonably available. Right? The other concepts the court considered when considering this claim under Revlon was the result perfect? What, does it have to be perfect? The answer is no, it has to be reasonable. There's more than one way to satisfy Revlon duties. There's no single blueprint. And the court examined from a process level what the board did to reach the result it did. And I think it's helpful to consider this claim in that context, Your Honor. If you would allow me, I think there are some other helpful points that I think we can make. Appellants have conceded that Section 102b7 is applicable here, and they need to state a claim for breach of the duty of loyalty. Your Honor, for very much the same reason, in Your Honor's decision as a vice chancellor in Fredericks of Hollywood, which was affirmed by this court in Malpede versus Townsend, their duty of loyalty claim fails for a lack of premise here. They failed to allege that the six outside members of the Activision board were interested in the deal or otherwise lacked independence.
You're now into the second leg of the argument. That is, even if there was a so-called Revlon violation, there's no culpability in terms of damages because there was no disloyalty here.
Correct, Your
Honor. In the negotiation process.
That's right. There are other, and I think it would be helpful if I speak to those points, and then I'm happy to circle back to the process as well. The deal was a strategic combination between two independent companies. There's no allegation to the contrary. The transaction was negotiated at arm's length. Activision had an 8-member board at the time of the Vivendi deal. An appellant fails to mount any real challenge to these six outside directors. And that fact alone warrants a dismissal of the claim of this case because their duty of loyalty claim fails for lack of a premise.
Well, it is alleged that they were dominated by the inside directors who were conflicted, though, isn't it?
That's true, Your Honor, although I would submit, in light of what they don't allege in the complaint, that that's conclusory. They're not alleged to have been on both sides of the deal. They're not alleged to be affiliated or otherwise employed by Vivendi. They were not alleged to have received any separate or unique payment in the transaction, these six outside directors.
But starting with the premise of my question,
yes,
if that allegation is sufficiently pled, it would state a basis for relief, right?
I think in the case where it was specifically pled, I think that would be so, but we don't think that that's the case here, and the court below did not believe that to be the case here either. There is no factual statement alleged in the complaint that suggests domination and control. In fact, to the contrary, they were alleged not only to have been independent and disinterested for purposes of the Vivendi transaction, they were at the same time the same independent board members were the ones negotiating at arm's length with the two insiders they claim were conflicted. We don't think they were conflicted, but they were negotiating at arm's length with them over the terms of their own employment agreements, and there's no allegation to the contrary in that either. So these were not directors that were dominated or controlled in any sense, certainly not as alleged.
Well, let me interrupt you there. The allegation is that the insiders who were arguably conflicted did all the negotiating, provided all the information to the outside directors, and that the outside directors were looking for specific items in the transaction that they then abandoned. So if you put those three things together, one could infer that the inside directors were running the show and the outside directors were, for whatever reason, even though it may seem, you know, why would they do it, but apparently they let them control the deal. Wouldn't that be enough to satisfy the domination claim for purposes of a motion to dismiss?
But that's a good question, Your Honor. That's not what they allege. They allege in the complaint that this board and the independent board members on the Nomination and Governance Committee met a dozen times from April 2007 until the deal was signed in December 2007, met repeatedly, were involved in the negotiations. As alleged, this was an active board, and the independent board members were
active. Okay, but wait a second. Involved in the negotiations vis-a-vis the other side or just at internal board meetings?
Well, they were relying on Allen & Company for downloads about the negotiations, and that's, I don't think that's an unusual circumstance where the board is relying on its financial advisor and relying on certain point persons that are designated to be the negotiation points of negotiation contact with the other side. The board member, it would be fair to say that the board members here weren't picking the phone up and calling the other side and doing the negotiations one-on-one. They were relying on management. They were relying on their bankers. They were receiving information through those means. They were reviewing documents independently. Allen wasn't the only advisor involved. They had Skadden Arps was involved. McKenzie was involved at one point. They provided information to the board. This board had a lot of information. They met a dozen times. They were involved in directing certain aspects of the negotiations. As alleged, this was an active board. There's no aspect of this process that was secret from the board. They make that claim in their papers. It's not alleged in the complaint. In April, they allege in paragraph 45 of the complaint, let me just make sure I have that correct, I'm sorry, paragraph 49 of the complaint, that all of the pre-April 2007 discussions that management and Allen had with Vivendi were downloaded to the board at a board meeting in April 2007. The board was brought up to speed then, and then it met at various times throughout the process, a dozen times until the board, until the deal was approved. Allen Company was involved in the process. They received a fairness opinion from Allen & Company. They received valuation advice and a valuation presentation from Allen & Company. All that's alleged. The suggestion that Allen & Company had a conflict appears only in their papers before this court. It didn't appear below. It's not in their complaint. And the suggestion at its core is Allen & Company had a conflict because it expected to be compensated for its services in connection with the transaction. That claim is meritless. There's no law that suggests that that's the case. They don't allege that Allen & Company was on both sides of the deal. They don't allege that Allen & Company had some interest in the transaction or interest with Vivendi. They just allege they expected to be compensated. The terms of their compensation were fully disclosed. There was nothing secret about that. They're not getting paid by anything from Vivendi. So there's no conflict with Allen. And so this board was informed by its advisors. It met diligently throughout the process, as alleged. There's no allegation here that the Activision board did not understand the value of the company. And from a Revlon standpoint, that is a fatal non-allegation to their claim. Paragraph 25, they allege that the board received a full download of valuation information about Activision at the very meeting they met to approve the deal. Paragraph 45, they allege that even after the deal was agreed to and signed, they met a few months later and received another download of the current values of both companies in the transaction, both Activision and Blizzard, and concluded there that they could continue to recommend the transaction. Sorry.
Let me focus for a moment on your comment that about the fatal non-allegation that the board didn't know the value of the company. Let's assume the board did know the value of the company. The complaint alleges that the exchange ratio was fixed without regard to the value of either company.
Right.
So, you know, doesn't that create a Revlon-type problem?
It might, and I know they make that argument, but that's not what they allege. They specifically allege in the complaint that they allege in the complaint, from a factual standpoint, that Allen & Company had valued Vivendi Games between $8 billion and $9.5 billion. They quibble over that valuation, but they allege that. And under the exchange ratio, the value of Vivendi Games at the $27.50 deal price was approximately $8.1 billion. It fell at the low range of how Allen & Company was valuing Vivendi Games. So that's not it's not a fair allegation that they're making. It's not a fair argument. And there's other reasons the court below, and I would submit this court here should consider when considering whether or not they've stated a Revlon claim at all, let alone a claim for disloyalty, which we don't think they've done either. The appellant here has dropped any challenge to the deal protection provisions. There was no barrier to another deal coming along, and one never did between the 7 months from when the deal was signed up in December to when the stockholders voted on it. There's no allegation that there was a better offer or an offer that suggested that management might not be able to participate on a going-forward basis, and so management steered things towards Vivendi. No allegation of any other offer whatsoever. And I think, Your Honor, for all of those reasons, they don't state a Revlon claim here as alleged. The complaint, they make arguments, but the complaint, when fairly read like the court did below, it doesn't stand up. The allegations about domination control are conclusory in light of all of the allegations repeatedly made over and over about an informed and active board process. I think, though, it would be helpful to, if the court would permit, for me to focus a little bit about their loyalty allegations against Mr. Kotick and Mr. Kelly, because I think here's where their theory of the case, for the most part, falls apart. Their claim for disloyalty effectively hinges on two out of the eight directors, Mr. Kotick, who's the CEO and co-chairman at the time of the deal, and Mr. Kelly, who was the other co-chairman at the time of the deal. They argue effectively that these two sold out Activision stockholders in order to hand control the Vivendi and obtain valuable employment contracts in return. And, Your Honor, the complaint, they make that argument, but the complaint does not allege facts to support it. Among other things, it ignores the six outside board members that, other than a conclusory allegation of domination and control, they don't allege anything about those six outside board members. Mr. Kotick and Mr. Kelly are not alleged to be affiliated or employed with Vivendi. They're not alleged to be on both sides of the deal. The attempt to
I'd like to refer you to paragraph 38 of the complaint, which goes to a critical point, I guess a point that's critical to both sides. That paragraph alleges that the transactions were built around Vivendi's immutable position, a fixed exchange ratio. And the complaint goes on to allege it was determined early in the negotiation process that the valuation ratio of Games to Activision would be fixed at 47.4 to 52.6, regardless of the actual relative values of the two entities. This approach ignored the actual value of the assets contributed by Vivendi in favor of the irrational approach of pegging Activision's value directly to the wholly unrelated value of Games, and the complaint goes on.
Yes, Your Honor.
That's the allegation.
Correct.
why doesn't that suffice for purposes of a motion to dismiss? What justifies ignoring that allegation or disregarding it?
Yes, sir. Well, the appellants in paragraph 73 contradict themselves.
Okay.
Allen & Company had identified a range of Vivendi games of between $8 billion and $9.5 billion in terms of the value under that exchange ratio. So as the stock price of Activision increased for purposes of the negotiations, and it did increase throughout the negotiation period, and that was important because Vivendi was also contributing cash in the deal at a higher price. They also alleged that under the exchange ratio that when the price of Activision's value rose, correspondingly the value of Vivendi games would rise, and it fell within Allen's range. Now, they quibble about the range, and they quibble about Allen, but, Your Honor, I would submit, number one, I don't think it was an unreasonable view for the board to take, as alleged. Number two, I don't think it's evidence of disloyalty. And because of the Section 102b7 provision here, even if for some reason the control premium issue or the exchange ratio issue were to constitute a claim for breach of the duty of care because it was an unreasonable conclusion, the complaint should still be dismissed for failure to state a claim that's cognizable in light of the Section 102b7 provision. And Your Honor, I'm almost out of time. I do have one other overarching point that I think is helpful here. On Mr. Kotick and Kelly, I think the court below and in our papers, we cite all the reasons why their allegation of a conflict is illusory. The bottom line is that the independent directors of the Activision board approved those employment contracts, and there's no allegation that the old contract versus the new contract or the new contract and the change of control payments were even material to Mr. Kotick and Mr. Kelly in light of their very sizable 7.5% equity ownership in this company at the time of the deal. That equity ownership was worth hundreds of millions. Thank you, Your Honor.
I think it's fair to say that Mr. Micheletti and I have a different read of the complaint and the allegations and the story that it tells about the faithfulness of the fiduciaries here. It strikes me that in Mr. Micheletti's presentation that he and the defendants rely a great deal on Allen and the reliability of Allen's valuation. Another allegation in the complaint, however, is that Allen shoehorned that valuation, that range that he spoke about, the game's valuation, that Allen generated that range so as to fit the fixed exchange ratio, that it wasn't an independent valuation of games.
And what was the factual basis for that conclusion?
Well, we had a few. The first was that we've alleged that Allen lacked independence from management. And our allegation on that is that when Allen was preparing its valuation materials for the outside directors, management interceded and instructed Allen to use a certain set of projections which were more conservative than ones that management and Vivendi had access to. So we have an allegation specifically in the complaint that Allen acceded to management's request about valuation rather than allowing Allen to proceed in an independent fashion in doing its valuation. We've also alleged that when you combine that with the valuation work that Allen did do, that each time Allen had an opportunity to apply its judgment in the valuation, it did so to increase the value of games relative to the value of Activision. The result of that is to make the transaction look more fair, to look more palatable to outside directors, to stockholders, to whomever is evaluating the exchange ratio being offered. We've also alleged in the complaint that there was a time when Allen's or Activision's performance was so far beyond what anybody expected early in the year of 2007 that there was that they were compelled to raise the per share implied value of Activision in the transaction. We've alleged that simultaneous with raising that, Allen then went and increased its view of the value of games in a way that matched along the lines of the fixed ratio so that the fixed ratio would still show that it was a fair exchange, even though Allen lacked a basis to increase the value of games at the same time that it increased the value of Activision. So to the extent that Allen is a cure-all in this process, I don't think the complaint can support that.
I'd like to ask, if you are inviting us to adopt a per se rule that a conflicted director who may be a company's strongest, best negotiator can never be designated to take the point by disinterested directors, that there's
not
loyalty in that circumstance?
Not at all. And in fact, a case that the defendants have relied on regularly, which we haven't taken any exception to, is the Mone case, in which a potentially interested CEO was designated as the point person for the negotiations. However, the outside directors used a strong hand with them, regularly exerted themselves in the process, rejected deals that the CEO came back with. That outside board was the driving force in that transaction. All of that's what we don't have here. Here we have a board that wanted to get a control premium and didn't. My time is up.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We appreciate the arguments, and we will reserve decision and take a recess.